60129, In re Suzanne C. Saperstein, Justice Willett is not sitting in this call.
May it please the court. Mr. Willett will present argument for the relator. Relator will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please this honorable court. This is a case of first impression on the construction of a key provision of a uniform statute that has been adopted by all 50 states. The provision is section 159.204, and the statute is the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, which in the interest of time I will call UIFSA. This section has been adopted by all 50 states at the direction of Congress, which in 1996 in the Welfare Reform Act said if you did not adopt this statute, you no longer got your Title 4D money. A principal purpose of UIFSA was to vest exclusive jurisdiction over support orders in only one state at a time, which within the old practice under URISA and RURISA of having conflicting support orders, arguments about whether or not states were concomitant with each other and who should defer to who else.
Mr. Phillips?
Yes.
Sir, we have a November 29th letter, 2006, dated from Alan Levy, and with some attachments involved.
Yes, Your
Honor. Some orders attached. So what bearing does that have on this argument here today?
Well, probably
nothing.
Counsel for David, for the real party who submitted that, could say more of what bearing.
Well, what impact do you think it has? Because it's, quite frankly, muddled the water for me.
Well, there are part of the problem that is going on here is that two states are claiming jurisdiction over spousal support, Texas and California, and they both are continuing to act. Now, California has just said it is going to defer on the marital property division. That is the actual divorce part of the case until Texas acts, and then California will decide whether or not they should be ruling on that part of the case, too. But the California court has definitely decided, and I think properly so, that it has jurisdiction over spousal support. It clearly has jurisdiction over child support. Texas has conceded that. But these are some recent orders, in part, entered by the California judge, as that judge continues on down the path of deciding what he is and is not going to hear. Meanwhile, proceedings are proceeding in Texas. Both states have issued spousal support orders which are inconsistent, and the parties, in fact, cannot comply with both orders at the same time.
But we're going to have parallel proceedings regardless.
Well, they'll be parallel, but not on the same subject.
Of course.
California clearly has.
They're going to do child support. We're going to do property, and so we just.
Yes.
Which one spouse goes?
Correct. And property, we still. That's for another day, another time, another court, where that should properly be. But for now, Texas is going to have a trial in January on property division.
Did both sides agree that that's where the property division? I know that's not the heart of this case, but that should take place in Texas.
No. Suzanne, the relator, claims that should be in California. But that's
right.
That's next year's problem.
Well, but one of the underpinnings of that problem is the argument's been made that you can't really separate spousal support from child support. They're just too interrelated. They need to go together.
That's
presumably the purpose behind 159.204B. But isn't there an argument also that the separation of spousal support and property division is pretty inextricably intertwined, too.
In the easiest case is where everybody lives in one state. There's no doubt about that. But we believe that a determination has been made by the Texas legislature and all other legislatures that spousal support and child support should start, at any rate, in the same state as possible. And that's not a determination for courts, either trial courts on a case-by-case basis or Supreme Court. It's
well,
been made by the legislature.
Along that line, what does the if relevant mean under subsection 3?
We think it means that if a couple has no minor children, no unemancipated minor children, then you're going to have spousal support determined in the state where the divorce was first filed. But if there are minor unemancipated children, that spousal support and child support should go together to whichever state under this scheme prevails and has exclusive jurisdiction.
Let me ask you about Part A of the statute. It says a tribunal of this state may exercise jurisdiction. And you talk about that as being whether the court has jurisdiction or not. But it kind of sounds like an abstention provision more than a jurisdictional provision. What's your view on that?
It's a reasonably unique statute. But I think its purpose is to get jurisdiction in one forum at a time only, one particular problem. A is the converse. That's what California looks at. The whole Part A of 159.204 is when you're the second filed state for divorce, and B is when you're the first filed state. The closest we can come to is perhaps removal. Certainly, a state trial court may have jurisdiction over an issue and over the parties. But if the defendant jumps through certain time hoops and certain subject matter hoops and gets into federal court under the United States statutes, then the federal court has exclusive jurisdiction. And the trial court no longer does, and of course the federal court can send it back. But I think that's the closest analogy. Certainly, for the Saperstein's, as the California trial judge found, Justice O'Neill, when making the spousal support orders, child support and spousal support overlapped for them in their housing and in the ranches for practicing racing and in their various types of air transport. It's even more important for a family of limited means, where the housing is frequently the biggest expense you have.
Excuse me,
and
what
spousal
you said?
Support and child support will overlap.
You said limited means? It's not a family.
If people have limited means, this is even more important to have the child support and spousal support being considered by the same forum that is aware of all these facts. Because otherwise you're quite likely to have double awards and double counting.
Well, and one of the problems, it's hard for me to envision how any court can do one without the other two. I mean, if you're dividing the property in Texas, say, for example, a property is given to Suzanne, but in terms of support, she needs a certain amount to maintain that property, which I presume would go under spousal support as opposed to property division. How do you look at those in a vacuum in each different place? I mean, spousal support could arguably be as relevant to property division as it can to child support.
Well, perhaps that's true. And perhaps that is especially true when we're talking about final spousal support, as rather than the temporary or interim orders that we're dealing with here. But it is a call that the legislature has made that we want, when there are children that are minor and unemancipated, we want the same judge looking at these support questions. Best interests of the child controlling. And presumably, if one state enters the final divorce order with an award of property and another state is looking at final support orders, whichever state goes first will take the other award into account.
What normally happens in these cases is child support, spousal support usually short and quick, and property is where most of the litigation is about, or am I wrong about that?
I would think that would be true.
Normally get rid of those pretty quick, and then
every state has some type of guidelines on support. They can vary from them, as the judges have done here, but there are guidelines. And so generally the fight, and certainly that will be the case here, is over how big this estate is, what's community and what's separate.
In which case then whoever decides the property can take into account, a just and right division of the property can take into account whatever court anywhere is decided on child spousal support, I suppose.
That's true, and it's also the converse is true.
Right.
Because jurisdiction continues over those support orders, and the judge that's handling that can take into account how the property has been divided.
Counsel, assume you're right under 159.204B of the Uniform Act, and assume that you're right that the three conditions in order to have a first filed lawsuit stick when the home state of the children is a different state. assume that your analysis there is correct.
And we don't want the first file to stick. We say under 159.204B, Suzanne, who filed second in California, has satisfied these three requisites.
Yeah, and you further argue that the respondents have not established that any of the three provisions have not been satisfied. So I understand your argument there. Then you say that the trial court lacks jurisdiction here in Texas. One of the most interesting parts of this legal matter to me is that the courts talked, they solved the dispute, discussed the statutes that apply, at least indirectly, referenced them in the conversation, and used the language of some of the statutes, at least. Maybe they didn't cite specific numbers and sections. And the statutes say that the courts may exercise jurisdiction. They say they may defer to another state's court. And the specific provision you're talking about in the comment, it says the intent is to encourage, quote, cooperation between and deference by sister state tribunals to avoid competing orders. And the courts, two courts, did that and settled on what they thought made sense here. And not with, of course, the California court was overturned by its court of appeals. But notwithstanding that, the two courts talked, trial courts talked. You say the Texas court lacks jurisdiction. So your argument is implicitly, at least, that the trial courts can't agree on, even with this language in the statute, to cooperate and talk and defer, can't agree on how to reasonably split up the parts of the case to avoid conflict. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Explain that.
You have to go back to the old system, which was ERISA and then RURISA, I think, is the one that the court's been dealing with in modern times, which relied on agreements. Well, unfortunately, there weren't always agreements. There were disagreements a lot. And so everybody agrees that the key purpose of UIFSA was to reduce trial court discretion and give the courts guidelines that they could follow. Now, what you're quoting from is a comment. And the comments certainly have some meaning, but they are not statutory language, and they don't trump statutory language. We think it's a good thing for the judges to talk. They did talk. Their entire conversation verbatim is in tab 4 of our handout, and they don't mention the statute. And the order of November the 2nd, which is tab D to our record, no, it's not, it's tab H to our record, does not mention UIFSA, and it doesn't track the language. It was purely a prudential thing. Well, we got a big case here. I'll take this. You take that.
Well, and that gets back to my question on the if relevant piece. I'd love to know if there's any legislative history. It seems like they could have easily said, and if there are children, the other home state of the children, or the other home state of the children, if any. But if relevant seems like an odd phrase to use. And can the courts decide the children are about to be emancipated, spousal support issues are more likely to focus on property division in this instance, and therefore it's not going to be as relevant to child support?
It's our belief. Well, first of all, I agree with everything you said about this could have been written better. There is, frankly, no legislative history, and I don't know what you call legislative history when a handful of uniformed commissioners get together, write a statute that the ABA then adopts, Congress directs every state legislature to pass, and, of course, they pass it on pain of great financial harm.
But it seems
that's preparatory.
It seems like that qualifier, if relevant, it could be very significant, because if it is intended to vest the individual courts with some sort of discretion to determine the relevance of the children's home state to the overall support issues, it could make a big difference in this case.
If it's read that way, it certainly could. We believe that that is probably not the best reading of this statute, because this is supposed to be a statute that the judges can sit down and they can tell who wins and move on.
Can you take one moment to tell us why appeal is not an adequate remedy?
Yes, I can. First, under prudential, current law, as I understand it, if you weigh the benefits and the detriments to this, certainly there's a tremendous detriment to these parties in having to proceed in two fora at one time. And that detriment is even stronger in cases where people are very limited resources and the lawyers are going to get all the money rather than the children or the spouse or the marital estate. You are the first court to decide this issue. Temporary orders are not appealable. At the rate we're going on these two trains, ma'am, finishing.
Yes.
At the rate we're going down two parallel tracks, it may be years before the parties have the benefit of knowing which set of orders they should have been following all along. And it seems to me in these cases where interstate comity is involved, and it's clearly the intent of this law that one court not have jurisdiction, that all of our jurisprudence in this state over the last 30 years would say it's a proper case for mandamus.
Just one follow-up question. If the trial were in January, would that moot this case?
No, it does not, because the interim support would continue on until there's a final judgment, and then in either state there will be issues about permanent support. This money makes a lot of difference. I mean, under California law, permanent spousal support is much a bigger issue than it is in Texas law.
The transcript of the conversation between the judges, they say that there's a dispute about the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. They use the terminology of jurisdictional challenge pending. They talk about home state of the children, all terminology from the statutes. I'm going to come back to that.
All right. I see where you are on page 6. They do use the terms. They don't look at any of the three criteria in making this decision.
In the interest of time, I guess I want to know in rebuttal, can the trial courts ever agree on something that makes sense without, from your standpoint, violating the statute if it may suggest something different?
I'll answer that when I come back.
The court is ready to hear argument from the real party in interest.
May I please support Ms. Liberato with that argument for the real party in interest?
May it please the court. Let me start with the issue of mandamus and the point that several of the questions have indicated that what are the standards that apply here and is a mandamus proceeding appropriate in this situation? The answer to from our standpoint, of course, is that it's not because there is an adequate remedy by appeal and because the judge did properly exercise her discretion.
How could you appeal it?
You can appeal the plea and abatement. That's what they are. They are challenging is the plea and abatement and her assumption of jurisdiction, and they could appeal that.
But you couldn't appeal. You probably couldn't raise this issue after final judgment, or could you?
After final judgment in Texas, that's correct. You could raise it in a final judgment.
And say the temporary support shouldn't have been what it was.
Well, what it would be is not the temporary support, but the ongoing support, because the spousal support would continue beyond the, assuming it's awarded in Texas, but it would continue or not continue on after the final judgment. So it would still be ripe in that sense as it continued on. Now, as it worked through the appellate process, I suppose there's an argument that it could be ultimately moved because there's a time limitation of 3 years for spousal support in Texas, and if it took that long to get through the appellate process, then arguably it would be moved. But nonetheless, it would be David that's paying that spousal support. I think that's a really important issue, too, in terms of the harm discussion that was touched on, and that is that David is paying for all the support, all the living expenses of the one child he does not have custody of. That's the youngest child, who is Suzanne, has custody, of course, for the two children he has custody of, and he's paying for all their living expenses. The other aspect, of course, is the abuse of discretion. And here, the statute clearly contemplates that the judges exercise discretion in making the determination of who's going to accept jurisdiction over spousal support.
That's not usually something the judges can agree about.
But it is here, and this is a weird duck, no question about it. Family law is that way.
If it were abstention or something like that, maybe you could agree. But if it's subject matter jurisdiction, that's usually determined out in the sky someplace, and trial courts are bound by it.
Well, that's right. And maybe there's a way to parse it a little bit here, aside from just saying that family law matters are unique, but it's really more of an abstention. It's not a complete, it's one court accepting jurisdiction while the other court defers, not completely giving up jurisdiction.
Well, except the statute says that you may not exercise, trial courts may not exercise jurisdiction if those three conditions are met. Right?
That's right. I think there's two aspects of that. Number one, that in the comment says that the courts will confer, and the language in the comment is discretionary type language, where it says the courts, depending on the circumstances, one of the two tribunals should defer, not must defer, but should defer. And then the second aspect is if you look in the same statute, under the first part of 204, under A, it says that the second filed court may defer. And so that's discretionary language, too.
So it's only if, though, at the end of that.
Only if, that's right. Now, so that allows discretion if those factors, then the courts apply those factors. But if you accept, or if one accepts Suzanne's analysis of those factors, there can be no discretion.
Because wasn't that the purpose? Wasn't that the purpose of this act, to prevent competing orders, to take away that discretion, to make it crystal clear?
Well, it certainly was to prevent competing orders. But with the courts looking at the situation and determining which court is the appropriate court to go forward. And I think this is an important point to make here, is that from the very start, Suzanne understood what this statute meant, because she followed it exactly. What it means is that the courts will confer what she asked the Texas court to do in her plea and abatement was not to dismiss for want of jurisdiction, but what she asked is the court abate proceedings to allow the California court to determine whether it would be accepting jurisdiction over the support orders. That's exactly what the statute contemplates. And so she knew that, so she asked for the right type of relief in her plea and abatement. The trial court, keep in mind, actually granted her plea and abatement.
But it was filed subject to the special appearance that said the trial court had no jurisdiction.
Right, but that was a challenge to in personam jurisdiction, not to subject matter jurisdiction. And so this was the subject matter jurisdiction, the subject matter being the spousal support. And that special appearance was denied, but again, that was in personam jurisdiction. So she knew what she was asking for. She knew the right procedure, but she didn't like the result. And the result, keep in mind too, if I may just put this all in context, what's the result? The California court was the one who deferred. As you look at the transcript that's been provided to you here and is in the record, and in their discussion, it is the California judge who does virtually all the talking, but nonetheless, at the end of all the talking that he does, he says, I'll take child support and I'll defer to you on spousal support,
but
and she says, okay.
But presumably, if he'd known what the Court of Appeal told him later, he wouldn't have made that decision.
But the Court of Appeal later didn't make a substantive ruling, Judge, and I think that's really confusing, but it's really important here, too, to understand that, and your question raises that, and I'm glad you did, because all the California court did was to say, go back and be sure you're applying the California law, you're not just making an agreement. He didn't say what California, the Court of Appeal did not say what California law was.
Well, but they kind of have now, haven't they? Because the trial court determined what it was, and now there's been, the appellate courts have pretty much accepted that. Now, I realize you say that denying the petition doesn't mean they've accepted it, but it's a pretty good indication here.
Well, I don't think so, Judge, not any more than if I file or any party files a mandamus to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals denies that mandamus, and then we file our next mandamus up here and you deny it, that's no substantive ruling. It could well be what the California court decided is you need to follow your adequate remedy by appeal, that mandate isn't proper here. There is absolutely no indication from the California court that they're making a substantive ruling. They're really refused, or I think if it's refused, but maybe denied.
One more question on that same point before we change, if I may. California Court of Appeals,
Appeal. It's hard to say.
Court of
California
Appeal.
Court of Appeal.
And the part we're talking about may have not have made a substantive ruling, but seemed to clearly indicate to the trial court, we're not really happy with what you did, when it says, we conclude the respondent court exceeded its jurisdiction when it ordered that the issue of spousal support should be adjudicated in Texas, not California, and the respondent court did not purport to base its decision on California law. If I'm the trial judge, that's a signal to me that the higher court didn't like what I did, and I'm going to reassess it, which it did then. So the argument then, coming from the other direction, which you've seen in writing and heard, is the plea and abatement was granted, went to California. The trial court in California made the wrong decision the first time, the right decision the second time, and therefore there's no more deferral to the Texas court. It all should go to California. Why shouldn't we look at the Court of Appeal decision in California as being the answer to the opportunity to make a decision rather than the trial court in California's first decision?
I think there's a kind of two-part answer. The first part being that I think that's it's reading too much into what California did. But putting that aside, let's just assume for a minute that there was a substantive ruling in California by the California Supreme Court that is absolutely positively against us. Just assume that for a minute. Hadn't happened, but assume that for a minute. They're applying California law. This court applies Texas law. Their decision is not applicable to what this court,
but
the decision of this court.
Both applying interpretations of the same uniform statute.
That's correct. That's correct. Although, frankly, their statute is a little different from ours because they are following the earlier version of the statute, and that's the one that is in effect in California now, and we're following a later version.
But for purposes of the provisions we're looking at here, that doesn't matter, does it?
Not in this particular regard. It does in regard to another issue on continuing exclusive jurisdiction,
right.
But that's correct. It's not a difference.
Section 159.204b3, what does if relevant mean?
If relevant means that the courts exercise their discretion to determine whether the issue of the home state of the child is going to be relevant to the property.
Do we have any guidance on how to interpret if relevant? I mean, you could read it to say if relevant meaning if there are children, or you could read it to import some sort of discretionary piece. And do we have any help on that?
I think that the only real help on that is in the comment and just the overall approach and purpose behind the statute. I think that's the help. And I think in another sense, if you will, and this isn't direct authority, and I can't help myself but to say at this point that's one reason mandamus isn't appropriate here, because the law has not developed and it should develop in the normal process. But putting that aside, practically speaking, just thinking what's going on here, what are the courts trying to do? They're trying to make the most sense out of which court should hear these types of unique issues that come up in family law cases. In this situation, there are two parallel trains headed down the track, and the question is, did the trial court judge abuse her discretion in determining that spousal support was more appropriate with the division of property than it was with child support?
But there was nothing in that discussion that dealt with propriety. I mean, it was not how old are the kids and what's this going to relate to more. If there had been a substantive discussion, I might agree, but it really was just sort of you take this, I'll take that.
It was, but courts don't have to explain their decisions, and I have to say they were fully briefed on it. There were briefs filed on this issue in California. There were briefs filed on this issue in Texas, so they were aware of the issues. But to take it one step further, if I may, Judge, and that is to why it's so logical, why that would be the right, putting aside discretion, it was the right decision, is because in Texas we have very limited alimony, very limited. But we make up for that because we give the trial court a lot of discretion in the award of property, a just and right.
But again, if my question to opposing counsel, if the support orders rendered pretty quickly because they're generally governed largely by guidelines. We can still do that once those are decided out in California. We can do our, we can adjust our just and right determination here. If we know, if we let the California court go ahead and decide spousal support, then we can make that adjustment here when we just, because the property is going to be tied up for years. Y'all will be back up here on property several years from now.
But we'll have a final judgment in January or February, final for purposes that Texas views as final judgments. We will have that in January or February after the trial is over, depending on how long it takes, but it's set for January.
Is that, would that be another reason for the court not to grant mandamus?
I think so, yes, Your Honor. That would be another reason.
Well, let me turn to on the mandamus again.
Right.
Assume that we agree with Mrs. Saperstein that the court did not have subject matter jurisdiction. The Texas court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction over support, spousal or otherwise. Then, if that's true, then the court has no business, you know, ordering deposition, potentially sanctioning parties, ordering appearances and that sort of thing. It has no power over that aspect of the case. Haven't we held in the past that a court without jurisdiction is subject to mandamus to the extent that court issues orders over subject matter that, I mean, that it has no jurisdiction over.
If the Texas court had no jurisdiction, then her orders are void, and the court's issued mandamus in that situation. That's right. Now, the court has also issued mandamus when there's conflicting orders.
That's
but
right.
Those cases, if in taking it to that step, those cases are always conflicts within the state of Texas. This is a conflict. Potentially with the California court,
but what's
and that's a different situation.
But it's a different situation, but it's no different problem.
In fact, it may be even more compelling for us to get involved when our state and another state court is conflicting.
If our judge did the wrong thing, but our judge did the right thing, their judge did the wrong thing.
I mean, you make a compelling argument that judges, in this instance, should try to work these issues out, and it appears that they did, albeit there could have been a mistake. But opposing counsel argues otherwise. They don't have that authority under the statute. Could you please address that?
That's what it comes down to, Judge. That's exactly right. At least is one of the fundamental issues. I mean, once you get past, is mandamus even appropriate here? But substantively, that's the issue.
How does the postnuptial agreement impact our decision here?
The postnuptial agreement says that the law of Texas applies, and I think from a policy standpoint, it applies. I don't think it directly applies to the decision on jurisdiction. Where I do think it applies, though, is to go back to the question of whether child support's relevant, or if the relevant issue is the split of community property. I think that's so we know that issue is going to be determined under Texas law and under the postnuptial agreement, although in fairness they have a dispute over the validity of the postnuptial agreement.
Did
so I think that's where it fits in, is back there.
Did that agreement play any role in the either the California or this court's support determinations?
No. But it does, by extrapolation, that may be too direct an answer. I'm going to answer you directly, but there is implicated only in so far as the property division will be done in Texas. And I want to clarify something here too. There has been no dispute in Texas by Suzanne that Texas does not have jurisdiction over property. In other words, she hasn't disputed Texas jurisdiction over the property division in Texas. She's done that in California, but not in Texas. So that will go forward.
What if there had been no agreement among the courts here, and we were just looking to the statutory language?
Well,
wouldn't we be directed to send the spousal support issue to California?
I think it depends on whether the trial court abused her discretion. I mean, I think that the factors apply. She would have applied the factors in issuing her order accepting jurisdiction.
Well, let's take that as the case.
Okay.
Let's take everything happened here without the conversation between
right.
the two trial
right.
courts.
Right.
And the trial court here had taken jurisdiction over the support order, as had the California court over the spousal support. What would our situation be then? We'd have to look at the plain language of the statute.
Right.
And it seems to me the plain language would say spousal support would have to be decided in California.
But the plain language doesn't say that. I mean, I think the plain language says that you take into account these three factors, and then the question goes in, is did she abuse her discretion in determining that the third factor, just focusing now on the third factor, that the home state of the child was relevant, and therefore it went to California, or the home state of the child was not relevant, and therefore she kept it. So I think that there's still a discretionary analysis.
So that's
that
just whether. So if relevant just means whether the trial judge feels like it.
Well, if that's what discretion is, then the answer
is yes.
But
the whole purpose of this was so we wouldn't have trial judges deciding these on what they felt like.
Absolutely true, and that's what happened here. That's what happened right from the start. The problem is in California, Judge. The problem isn't with our Texas judge who did the right thing.
But California is the home state of the child.
Home state of the child, that's right. But Texas is where all the the property division is going to be made, where David's business is.
When whoever was drafting this, all 50 states, they didn't put property in here. They didn't put anything in here, really, other than timing stuff and where's the home state.
That's right. So the question
so
is what
does this, if the trial judge can disregard the home state, then all this is a timing statute, and then trial judge is just, we're back where we were, aren't we? Just do whatever you want.
Well, no, I think that the trial judge can consider that there are situations where the home state of the child would be relevant to the decision of the spousal support decision.
But your argument
it
wouldn't be relevant if the property is mostly somewhere else.
Well, if the property division is being made in, I'm saying the trial court didn't abuse her discretion in making the decision that property division here meant that that was relevant and that made the child where the home state of the child was irrelevant. And in fact, factually here, the home state of the child is irrelevant. There is no reason for it to be decided there as far as the relevancy of the home state of the child being out there. David has custody of two of the children. He is paying for all.
That's all you're arguing in this case.
Okay.
But there could be 100 other cases
where
we're going to be faced with the argument that relevant means something other than whether we're deciding property division.
Well, and I think that's right. I think there are circumstances to be sure that if relevant, that the home state of the child could be relevant to the determination of spousal support. It's just not here. The judge didn't abuse her discretion. Mandamus is not appropriate.
Chief Matt. How would you answer opposing counsel's argument that we have been through a statute where we tried to get the trial judges to agree on it, and now we've moved to another statute because that didn't seem to be working out throughout this whole family law process?
Well, my recollection, Judge, and I could be wrong, I don't think the early ones contemplated the judges talking together, and I could be wrong on that, but I don't remember that they actually were to talk under the previous statute. That what would happen is that there was, you know, that each judge could issue a separate order. Okay, the same thing.
But it's a practical matter. We did in some instances have the judges in different states talking, and we ended up.
That's right.
And we had difficulties with that, as I understood his argument being, we had difficulties with the judges talking and just didn't get it done, so we've now moved to this statute. Do you have any response to that?
And I do, and that is that we are in agreement that's the purpose of the statute, to avoid the conflict, and that these judges did the right thing. They talked. Even if they hadn't talked, there's still no conflict because the California court deferred, and now and changed its mind later, but I don't know of any circumstance where the later action of another court, another state, can change the jurisdiction of Texas, and that's essentially what they've done. So the right thing happened, the right result obtained, it's just that they didn't like it and now challenged it.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Justice Wainwright, like removal, a party can have a right to do that and can choose not to avail itself of that right. And the parties could have decided that they wanted the Texas court to hear this. Once one of the parties wanted California to hear it, even though Texas was the first filed state of the divorce, I believe the underlying purpose of UIPSA was to take that discretion away from the two judges and provide a bright-line rule that would decide what court had exclusive jurisdiction. They could have written it better, but if relevant to us, means that there are minor unemancipated children and that those children have a home state. Opposing counsel cited this case from Virginia where one minor child lived in California and one minor child lived in Virginia. Now, they didn't talk about this section of UIPSA, but they left the children where they did not go into home state of the child in deciding where child support could be decided.
The two temporary orders are certainly inconsistent. Are there direct conflicts? So that one judge says you've got to do this and the other judge says you can't do the same thing?
Yes, in some instances. We know that the Simi Valley, which is a horse ranch, that one judge says you'll get some limited use over it and the other one says you don't. I believe they are different at any rate. There were more differences about some of the other property, the ski resort in Colorado and Malibu. But the California judge just a week ago deferred to some findings that the Texas master, Joe Reynolds, had made and tweaked the support order. So there are fewer of those conflicts, but we think there are still some. And, of course, there's money conflict, and the California judge just last week ordered Mr. Saperstein to write a $375,000 check to catch up on the arrearages because he was honoring the Texas order. So that's money, you know, that he'll have to try to get back or that some final later order will have to adjust if California didn't have to.
But the California court said he wouldn't have to pay under both.
That's correct. They're giving him credit. Exactly.
You talked when you first stood up on rebuttal, counsel, about the parties being able to agree. Were you distinguishing that from the case here where the trial judges just reached an agreement, the parties didn't agree to that?
If that was all that was required, there either you wouldn't have three categories in Section 204 or you'd have a proviso, provided that if the judges have a better idea and they both agree on it, that will control. It does not say that. It has categories that at least attempt to provide clear guidance that one state has jurisdiction and one state does not have jurisdiction. The second requirement was mentioned by opposing counsel on jurisdiction. That's a little unclear as well, whether the timely assertion of jurisdiction has to be made is lack of personal jurisdiction or lack of subject matter jurisdiction. We believe whichever it is, Suzanne clearly complied with both. She filed a special appearance that met all the requisites of Rule 128, asserted lack of personal jurisdiction, also mentioned subject matter jurisdiction.
In a different context, though.
It did not mention spousal support because David hadn't sued for spousal support, and it's rather hard to tell a judge they don't have jurisdiction over something that's not in the lawsuit at the time. Then after Judge Millard on her own said, you know, I think I'm going to look at spousal support, immediately Suzanne went out and filed a plea and abatement. And we've talked about that plea and abatement. Prior to the judge making her ruling, she also filed, at the judge's request, a detailed brief that went into Section 204 and its requisites in great detail. And orally, prior to the judge making the ruling, Suzanne pointed out that under 204, the judge did not have jurisdiction over spousal support. So, taking those singly or all together, I don't believe there's any doubt that Suzanne met the requisites of subsection 2. And, of course, there's no doubt about subsection 1. She timely filed her own lawsuit.
Counsel, under your position, in order to get mandamus, do we have to say as a matter of law under B3 that when the child resides in California, when the child resides as this child under these facts in California, as a matter of law, that makes that home state relevant, forecloses any discretion on the trial court.
Yes.
And that means then if Suzanne comes to Texas, and California is a home state, and comes to Texas and say, let's just do the whole thing over here, Texas still does not have jurisdiction. Because you can't agree on subject matter jurisdiction. If we've taken relevant and said California is the home state of the child, that makes that takes the discretion out. And that means she can't come over here now because once that's the home state, we still can't do it over here.
On spousal support, that's right.
On spousal support.
Child support would change because it follows the
Well,
change.
This is a funny kind of jurisdiction, though. This you can waive completely by not filing your lawsuit in another state on time, right?
There are many ways to waive this.
So it's not, as the U.S. Supreme Court said, there are many kinds of jurisdiction.
And this
Sometimes
may be,
we don't know what they mean when they have said that.
This may be its own kind of jurisdiction.
Well, let me follow up on that then. She has, in fact, complied with B1, petition she filed timely, B2. Can she now come over, or is she locked in? I mean, for future cases, not this one, but let's say that. The parties, they're going to be locked in under your view of this statute.
They are locked into California for spousal support, not child support. But this particular case, if the party who is advantaged by the application of California law were to say, I'd sure like Texas law, the parties could certainly on
dismiss
their own,
and start all over again.
That's right, dismiss and start a claim in Texas. So I think the problem is more apparent than real, but as a strictly legal matter, yes, spousal support under this law is locked in California.
Sir, there was a comment about some final ruling being made in January, as I believe it pertains to the property. What impact, if any, does that have on your mandamus request?
There will be a trial is set for January the 23rd in Judge Millard's court. There's already been one continuance of this trial. Hopefully it won't be continued, and it will go to trial at some time, February, March, or April, I would say. There may be a final order. The California judge still has jurisdiction over spousal support, and at some point that may change from what they call an interim order into a final order. But it has no effect on this mandamus in that there's still a problem of the Texas court issuing orders for which the Texas court has no jurisdiction, interfering with the jurisdiction of the California court.
Any further questions? The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.